to Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am Rabbi Richard Address, the director of Jewish Sacred Aging and the host of these podcasts. Thank you for joining us. As you know, Seekers of Meaning is designed to explore some of the issues related to our own aging, the implications of longevity for our families and community. And we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can send them to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And while you're there in cyberspace or whatever, just go to the Facebook page for Jewish Sacred Aging and check that out and like us as well. We have a very, very special program for you today, a very special podcast with a very special guest. One of the leading, one of the leading lights in Jewish music and Jewish activism right now in the United States, North America. And we welcome Perry Smilow, composer, Jewish educator, activist, whose mantra in much of her work is the concept of Tikkun Olam and the arrival of Tikkun Olam through various types of activism. One of the most popular and probably is known to many of you who have frequented synagogues, music, URJ biennials, other programs is that activism through music. So Perry, first of all, welcome. It's nice to see you. Hope you're safe and well. And thank you for joining us here on Seekers of Meaning. How you doing?
Hi, Rabbi. Thank you so, so much for including me. This is a really meaningful conversation for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Well, I hope everybody's safe and your family and everybody is vaxxed, boosted. It's everything that we have to do now. Just to stay safe. So there's so much I want to go over with you. And again, thank you for joining us. But I'm always interested when we talk to people who, what drew you to your performance, your writing, your music? What was there something in your childhood? Was there an encounter with someone or something that said, aha, this is something I want to do with my life?
I you know, all of us who are artists get these questions, and it's always a wonderful moment for self-reflection. So I think I have three answers for you, and they're pretty clear to me at this stage in my life. It took a while to have a quick answer, but I think I finally do. And the answer is, and first of all, I feel very lucky to have had this trajectory. The first thing is I was born with music. That's something I can't explain. At the age of 3, 4, 5, I was singing harmony to my birthday and the other kids laughed at me. It's just in me.
Oh, wow.
That there's no real explaining other than that it's just came to me. The second thing is that the activism piece, the Tikkun Olam piece came directly from my parents. My parents were young, nominally Jewish, nominally liberal New Yorkers who at the age of 23 and 25 got married and ultimately had me and moved to New Orleans, Louisiana in 1961. And it activated them. They showed up in a segregated South and realized that the world wasn't like the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it made them want to get involved. And so as the sort of, I don't know if it's apocryphal or real, but there's a story that's told in my family of origin that when I was 4 and 5 years old and I had white blonde hair and blue eyes, my parents would take me in New Orleans. And if I was thirsty, if we were out for a walk, they would take me to the colored only water fountains. And that's part of my story growing up. My parents in 1968 went to the March on Washington, sat us down as 8, 6, and 2-year-old, said, "We know this might be dangerous, but we have to go, and we hope you understand. We'll be home, and your grandparents are going to stay with you, but this is something that's important to us." So that came from them. And then the Jewish piece came from a very close relationship, sort of closest kind of relationship that my parents developed with Rabbi Harvey Fields, Alav Shalom, who was my congregational rabbi as a child, and who opened the door to ritual for my family in a fundamental way. We had nothing. We didn't know. We had got Christmas presents. We, you know, sometimes made Easter eggs. And suddenly there was this incredible opportunity for us to find meaning and purpose through Judaism. And Harvey and Sybil became my parents' closest friends on the planet and became like parents to me, and Harvey was my role model. So those three tracks led to where I am.
So, I mean, you mentioned Perry Ritual, and I'm fascinated by the growth. And it's one of the most requested things we do in Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm fascinated by the growth in new rituals, the openness now, people to create or revision their own rituals or traditional rituals. And music is such a powerful part of that. And your career has spanned what really seems to be the transition of synagogue music. When I was growing up at Knesset Israel in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, the music was very ponderous, you know. Oh, that's okay. Hi, what's the cat's name?
This is Thunder, everyone. Nothing like trying to be Thunder, a professional during a pandemic.
No, that's okay. We're used to it.
He'll be back. Forgive me.
I hope his friend is Lightning.
No, his friend is Rainbow.
Just say it. Thank you, Noah. But that music, ritual. You know, the old German hymns, and but your career has spanned this whole change in, you know, Jewish music, and the use of it in ritual. Talk to me about how your own career has followed that, and what spoke to you as you developed some of these new melodies and reinterpretation of old prayers and stuff like that. How is that done with? How did you feel with that? What was your spark? What was your inspiration?
So my first spark musically is an obvious one, and it was Debbie Friedman, right? So I'm the next generation behind Debbie and Cantor Jeff Klepper and Dan Freelander, who were ahead of by a, you know, number of years. I think one of the things that moved me early on was a recognition that the entire Reform movement found its way to the use of a traditional Jewish ritual, namely the recitation of a Mishaberach L'Cholim. We now call it the Mishaberach, but those who are very Jewishly knowledgeable will know that there's lots of Mishaberach. But what Debbie did was she said, you know, we need to communally think about those who are sick. And oh my goodness, we actually have something, we have a prayer in Judaism that's just waiting for us to reclaim. So that was a model for me, that her melody for the Mishaberach made the ritual accessible. It wasn't the other way around. It wasn't, oh, let's do this thing, and oh, let's find some music for it. It was, if we sing something that makes people want to sing, A, they're going to learn the Hebrew. You know, we can learn Hebrew, even if we don't know Hebrew, through singing. So I wanted to do more of that. So it made sense to me. I thought it gave people purpose. And I saw in our congregations how, one of the amazing things about Jewish life is that we have access through Jewish life to an unbelievable amount of ritual. But a lot of it we don't connect with as modern Jews, as Reformed Jews, right? So I just always thought that music was the best way to do that. So how did I feel about it? It's been exciting to watch. It's been really exciting to see this transformation. I have to say that, you know, and it's sort of obvious, but I feel like what cemented the shift was our own aging. What I mean by that is, you know, all of us who went to Jewish summer camps and who sang and who were given permission in the 60s, because that was another moment when ritual was opening up, when people were looking for self-identity, where they were looking to self-comfort as community. That was a time when we were all given permission by our rabbis and our community to just try it. Go ahead, try it, write something. What the heck? We'll try it. We'll try it on Shabbat and see if it works, right? And all those people who grew up having that experience that was so transformative that it made them want to be Jewish educators, rabbis, cantors, we're in charge now. Don't look now. Like, we're running the movement. We are the people who, and so we brought that meaning and purpose with us. The real question for me, to be honest, is what's happening in the next generation? And one of the things that I'm getting the most joy from is watching this mass, this ocean of young people who are beginning to create new and different ritual. The scary thing is, and I'll leave it here, is that it isn't always within the structure, the traditional structures of synagogue life. And that me, and it's music and it's art and it's culture and it's Jewish and it's Yiddish and it's ritual. And it's not, a lot of it's happening for young people, maybe outside of the structures that we found so helpful to us. So that's a quick, someone else to answer.
No, but they, but you put your finger on something that really we're living in the middle of, and that is this, what I call this age of transition. And a lot of it is coming out of, I don't need to do this within the traditional institutional model. I can do this on my own. And as you alluded to, the Jewish camping movements, the URJ camps, Ramah, the Ramah system, there's really been the foundation for a lot of this new music that in our generation that is now acceptable part of synagogue music. The camp system really produced this. It's, you know, I would venture to say when I teach at HEC, and I would venture to say the experience of other people from JTS and other, how many of these students have come through the camping movement in one way, shape, or form or another is overwhelming. And so to see that the music part of it is just part of this evolution and transition is natural, fulfilling. And as you say, now moving to the next generation, we don't know what's going to, but there is this explosion of many things. And part of that is taking a traditional ritual. For example, in your album Blessings, you do a setting for the Gomel blessing, a traditional blessing, which now has found a lot of new life in synagogue land. And we're going to insert Great. It here because walk me through real fast. You took this traditional blessing in the old days, if you went from city A to city B and you got to city B safely, thank you, God, I got here. So I wasn't beaten up, robbed or whatever. But now, right, this is a blessing that's being used, the revitalization of the mikveh, cancer survivors, I've survived an accident, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so walk me through real fast the process that you looked at this blessing. What motivated you to do this song on this album? What was the process?
Sure. So first of all, I have to out myself as a cancer survivor, actually as a someone who carries cancer as a chronic illness. And the whole album was about that experience. So this, my approach to Gomel was this desire in the same way, consciously. I sat down and I thought, you know what? Friedman was able to reclaim Mishaberach L'Cholim. I wanted to be able to do the same thing for Gomel. I want people to sing Gomel in congregations. Now, why? And it wasn't so much, I love the ritual, but why do I love that ritual? Because I think for me, the most important thing is the sustaining of community. No matter what's happening in our transition, Jewishly, structurally, I want to help sustain community, however it's going to look. And for me, Gomel is an essential piece, which is that when people go through struggles, it can be really hard to come back to community. And I see Gomel as that ritual. It's the ritual that says, allows the individual to come back into community and say, I just went through something terrible. Please welcome me back.
Right.
And the community has to answer and say, welcome back. And so I heard it in my head as a gospel choir. That's how it sounded in my head. Gomel to me felt like, okay, I come back and I say I'm here. Community answers. And then we have a dance party and we celebrate. We say, you're back. Yay. And that's what I wanted it to sound like.
So we're going to listen to it right now. And Harry Smilo's Gomel.
Blessed are you, Adonai. and grant us goodness forever. May you be with us and grant us goodness. Baruch Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Haolam Shek Malani.
We're speaking with Perry Mello, composer, educator, activist. Perry, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you real fast, what's the website? How does someone reach out to you?
Yeah, they get to me at perrysmilo.com. P-E-R-I, one R and an I, Smilo. Although you can also get to me through perrysmilo@gmail.com and you'll get to me directly.
I want to talk a little bit about this, the Tikkun Olam expression and advancement through other types of activism other than music, before we get to specifically dealing with some of their experience with longevity and aging. But I know this, that the other activism is very, very important to you. And talk to me a little bit about that side of Perry Smilo, which people may not know of.
Yeah, people are always surprised when I say, yeah, I have a master's degree in education from Harvard, and it was one of the most exciting and enriching and life-changing experiences that I had. Yeah, I think actually the way that I would frame it is, interestingly, that my musical life comes out of my interest in community, as opposed to the other way around. And so it has always made sense to me. It makes much more sense in the rearview mirror than it does while you're living it forward. That's something I'll say about getting to my sixth decade, is that it sort of all makes more sense now. it didn't make sense when I was an executive director of a nonprofit in Boston, and I was also singing on Friday nights in synagogues. And I found myself one Friday night on the Mass Pike going about 85, trying to make it in time because I had to work late. And I had to get to synagogue to sing. And I literally changed my into my pantyhose on the faith. So
thank you for sharing.
Thought people might get a kick out of that one. I actually left my shoes. I lost my shoes that night at a rest stop because I changed my shoes into my good shoes and I left my work shoes at the rest stop on the highway. Anyway, the thing that's in preparing to talk to you today, I actually had another realization, which is that how much of my work hasn't only been in the nonprofit sector, but specifically was intergenerational. And that when I was in my 20s and 30s, I was running organizations that worked with inner city kids and the elderly. And then when I got into my 50s, again, I found myself working with organizations that worked with inner city kids and the elderly. And that the work that I've done in synagogues, you know, one of the things that's always given me tremendous joy from my, how I thought about my music work was that I would come into congregations for a weekend as an artist in residence. And I always wanted to make sure that I was touching every silo of the congregation. I wanted to be sure that if I was doing a Tat Shabbat on Friday night before worship, you know, service for the community, that on Shabbat afternoon that I got a chance to meet with the older, you know, empty nesters. My dream was not just to meet with silos, but to help congregations figure out how to sew together all of these disparate pieces of who we are as communities. So I don't know if that's answering your question, but it's been a dual part of my life. I had a great fortune of being one of the founding staff members of an organization called City Year, which does community service. I founded an organization called Magic Me in Boston that worked with, again, elderly and inner city kids. I think it all stems from wanting to help spark the connectivity of community and the idea that I've just always felt, which is that the combination of gathering people around disparate ages helps to make much more meaning for each side of the age spectrum. And so a lot of my work has landed in those places.
And so what is your passion right now in that activist role? What is driving you right now in that Tikkun Olam gene that you've talked about that's running through your body? What is it now?
I think if you're asking about what topics are grabbing me, the topics that feel up front and center to me right now are racial justice is squarely in the center. I'm passionate about thinking about how to help Jewish young people remain activists or become activists and remain activists while, and there's an asterisk, being able to be on college campuses and be able to be knowledgeable enough about the Israel-Palestine divide so that they can remain intersectionally engaged in racial justice issues in the United States and still remain passionate about their Jewish identities. For right now, for me, that's one of the absolute central issues that I'm looking at. There are many, obviously, but that's one of the keys.
I got to ask you this question because your career has spanned this unbelievable period in American Jewish history, and you have a child in college, right?
I do.
Who's living her. Okay. So from your perspective of carrying this Tikkun Olam gene, if I can call it that, from your childhood, has the, in your perspective, because you're in synagogues, you taught, you're a scholar in residence, you're an activist, have we become too soft? Have we lost that passion to change the world? Have we become too comfortable?
Who's we?
The American Jewish, the typical American, there's not saying it's typical, but the people who are involved in our congregations, the 7 million people who allegedly identify as Jews in the United States of America.
Absolutely not. We have not gone soft, and we have not lost that gene. No, I think, you know, I think if you look back, even at the height of what we liberal Jews might think of as the height of Jewish connectivity and passion around social justice issues, if you looked then, I don't know this for sure because I'm not a researcher, but I'm going to guess that the numbers were small. They were loud, but small. I can't tell you how many people I know in my own world of all ages who are active. I just marched with 20 women from my synagogue for support women's marches that were taking place to for pro-choice. More active. There are things on college campuses happening every day. There are young people who are YouTubing. The thing is that it's sometimes harder for older people to tap into what's happening with younger people because of the explosion of social media. And there's so much happening, and it's so exciting, and they are so knowledgeable. The world is open to the younger generation in a way that it wasn't to all of us. They can open their computer or their phone and find out what's happening in Myanmar now, right now. They can watch what's going on. They could talk to someone in Myanmar now if they wanted to. The other thing is that if you listen to our young people in the Jewish community, they are deeply, deeply engaged and concerned about our planet. They're engaged and involved trying to get their synagogues to recycle. And I mean, it's everywhere. The real question is, are we, the older generations, willing to see and encourage the kinds of change that the younger people are advocating for? So the answer is, I guess, no, I don't think we're soft at all. I think it's very exciting what's going on, and I hope that we support what's happening.
No, thank you. Because the reason why, because in a lot of people are not aware of the explosion, because it's not being done, as you alluded to before, through traditional institutional means, like the rabbi standing up on a Friday night and giving the passionate sermon about, and in many congregations, they've reduced the Friday night so that, you know, you have 10 minutes to tell a nice little story, because we got to get there in an hour, but that's another program for another time.
But can I interrupt for a second? That's such a great example. So many of those communities where, how to describe this? Do you know, I'm going to be quick. Do you know the story about, there's this wonderful story about if somebody goes to visit heaven and hell, and they are trying to figure out what's the difference between the two? In hell, they go and they see this beautiful buffet, and people are trying to eat, but they have boards on their arms, so they can't get the food to their mouth, so they're starving. And then they go to heaven and they see exactly the same thing. People have boards on their arms, and there's this big table set with food. But people are happy and they're robust and they're eating. How are they eating? They're eating because they're feeding one another. They've realized that's what heaven is, that they've realized. Okay, so now, I don't know why this connected for me to this question, but what you said was, you know, they've sort of diminished this and the role of the rabbi. So there are congregations that look very much the same, that are the same size, have the same amount of time that the rabbi speaks on Friday night, and yet one congregation is deeply, passionately engaged, involved, coming, and the synagogue gets used around the clock. People are there on Tuesdays at noon learning with the rabbi. They come with their children to be blessed. They have weddings on traditional Jewish wedding days, which goes beyond Saturday night or Sunday. And they are doing tikkun olam. They meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays to work at the food pantry, and the rabbi does it alongside them. Those congregations are very healthy. It's not that the institution, and the question is, are we willing to share power? Are we willing to see roles change? And are those who are leading us able to do what I have always thought is their key role, which is to serve as mentors and guides and teachers? And if I'm gonna work at a food pantry, I could either do it at my local church because they're feeding the hungry, or my synagogue could teach about hunger. Let me learn, let me do daf yomi about hunger. Let me learn about what Torah tells me about hunger. And then when I actually am engaged, I'm gonna find meaning and purpose, and my rabbi's gonna be with me in my heart and my soul while I'm doing it. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's,
well, no,
I don't think
but
we have to lose our institution.
No. I don't want to ever say we lose our institutions. But the point of all this, and I'm glad you got that, is we are in this, what I'm absolutely referred to as this age of transition. So the institutions, well, first of all, the institutions that will survive, like the synagogue you talked about, are those institutions that are open to the new, that are open to the future, that are not willing to take a risk, to lech lecha, to have a lech lecha moment. Those synagogues who say, we've always done it this way, and this is our structure, and there's no need, they'll be out of business within 5 years. I believe that 100%. And a part of that is being driven not only by the boomers, but also by the younger generation, who say we want more. We don't need as many Bubba Mices and miracle stories, but we want tachlis. We want some, because the world has become so much more complex, and that we need a Judaism that speaks to that complexity and speaks to my neshama and all the stuff that I'm concerned about, hopeful for, and afraid of. Because with the pandemic, as we all know, now that we're in our second winter of this, there's a lot of anxiety that's not free-floating anymore. It's there. So that's an interesting segue, I would imagine, into your work with older adults and the use of music with that constituency that you also work with. Music is very, very powerful, and I've seen it with Alzheimer's patients. Is it true that I've been told that in the part of the brain that processes music, that's the last part of the brain to really move away from what we consider reality? Yeah. Has that been your experience? And what has been your experience with that?
First, I want to say, if there's anyone out watching who hasn't seen the Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett special on television,
yes, it's really what
speaks right to this question. Yeah, no, my experience is
absolutely
this. I actually have an example. I was working in inner city Boston, and I had a group of sixth, seventh, and eighth graders who were like beating each other up in school. They were constantly getting thrown out of school. So I took them to a nursing home once a week, and there was an elderly woman who always sat in the corner. She was affectless. She did nothing. She just sat. And we were told, don't, you know, we'll put a child next to her, but tell the child not to expect much from her. I don't know how it happened. Somehow I looked over, and this little boy had said something to this woman about music. And she turned to him and said, I play the piano. And not knowing any better, this little boy saw a piano in the corner, and he said, oh, let's go play. I play too. Let's go play. And this woman, who had no language, no anything, completely affectless, stood up, went hand in hand with this little boy over to this piano. She opened the piano and started to play and sing. And the staff from the nursing home, word got out that this lady, who never heard say anything, was singing. And everybody came running to hear her. And she sang for about 10 minutes. And she closed the thing. She went back to her chair. And that was it. She didn't speak again. So the answer is, yeah, I've seen it. It's incredible. It's our reptilian brain. You know, it's that thing that's way back there.
But it's also I'm sure you've had this I can't say what you've had, but I've seen it. It triggers memories, and memories trigger stories. Where was I when I heard this song? This is what I fell in. This song was our wedding song, or this song I remember playing when I heard this news. And when you work, we work with groups.
I like to call it the soundtrack of our lives. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I like
yeah.
To call that, it the soundtrack of our lives.
It's an often old. It's also often, I think, of an old Sinatra album. The which is sitting downstairs. Perry, I know that you've had experience in congregations and assisted living facilities, and you have this passion of, as you've talked about, of really reaching baby boomers, our generation. You have a particular song, I think it's called Carry On.
Yeah.
That really speaks to this, correct? It speaks to this work,
it speaks to the idea of as we age, and in, you know, look, no one wants to talk about dying. It's the elephant in the room, right? So I'm going to name it and say it. And it just may be that because I've carried cancer for 22 years, that it's more in my frontal lobe than elsewhere. So this piece is about, what do we do with that existential idea that we know that we're going to die? And it's...
So what I'm going to ask
how
you
do we
to do
make, is, and how do we make meaning?
So what I'm going to ask you to do is play us out, if you don't mind. To first of all, real fast, again, your website, if people want to get in touch with you.
Thanks, Ruthie. It's perrysmilo.com.
And so before we have Perry playing us out for this, and again, thank you. Thank all of you again for watching or listening to this edition of Seekers of Meaning. If you'd like to make a tax-free donation, and we really do appreciate it, so we can continue these podcasts and our work, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com. Go to the donate button that's down on the bottom. Click it and just follow the prompts. And we're very, very grateful for anything you can do to help support our work. A big thank you to our producer, Steve Lubetkin, because these are recorded at his studios of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill. And just stay safe, everybody, and we'll see you next week on the next edition of Seekers of Meaning. Just shalom, be well, stay safe, get vaccinated if you haven't. And we close with this lovely song for us from today's guest, activist, composer, educator, Perry Smilo. Go ahead, Perry.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. Write those checks, everyone. Send your money in. Can you hear me all right there in the studio? Okay, great. He turned to her and he said, "Love, I've nothing to leave you. Save for the memories you and I gathered for years. Now I am weary and I have grown old, and my ears and my eyes, they are failing. But weep not for me as I travel this path set before me." He said, "Carry on, sing for tomorrow, carry on, dance for today, carry on, your spirit will carry you, blessings will find you along the way, carry on." "My mother died young," she said, "so I'm not shocked about this. I just want to have enough time to get out on the town. I'll travel the world and I'll drink hard and maybe I'll marry. And when it's all over, don't cry for the life I've not lived." She said, "Carry on, sing for tomorrow, carry on, dance for today, carry on, your spirit will carry you, blessings will find you along the way, carry on." He said, "Frankly, there's too much to do to take time off for healing. I've got to be sure that the work can go on when I've gone. Promise me that you will travel the path that we've started, leaving the world a touch better than when we arrived." He said, carry on. Sing for tomorrow, carry on. Dance for today, carry on. Your spirit will carry you. Blessings will find you along the way. Carry on. Sing for tomorrow, carry on. Live for today, carry on. Your spirit will carry you. Blessings will find you along the way. Carry on. Carry on. Carry Thank you, and thank you. Be well, everyone. Thank you for this blessing.
Thank you. May blessings follow you. Take care, everyone.